no one is really quite sure how it will pan out. There will be some campaigning, obviously, before the election is held. They haven't decided on the timetable yet for the election of a new leader. The National Executive Council, the ruling National Executive of the Labour Party, meets on May the 25th, that's the week after next, at which it's thought that they will actually sit down and say, right, we've got to sort out a timetable, in which case many expect a new leader to be chosen, perhaps mid-July, at a special conference of the Labour Party.
It's a very difficult time, of course it is. But, of course, there are those who are saying that by prolonging speculation, it makes it an increasing problem, and the battle becomes extended, and that's what they don't want to have to do in public, at least, anyway.
Exactly. They have managed to keep many of their differences between themselves for quite a while now, and if they had put off a leadership contest until the autumn, at the time of the next party conference, many felt that it would give much more time for what could become quite a divisive contest between the modernisers on one hand and perhaps some of the old guard. And the unions at the moment are a little bit suspicious of Tony Blair. They don't mind Gordon Brown, but they're a bit worried about Tony Blair. No one is quite sure exactly where he's coming from, apart from the fact he's coming from the moderate or the right wing of the Labour Party.
Mm. If either of those were to become the new leader of the Labour Party, in effect they've skipped a generation, haven't they? I mean, Mr. Smith died very young. He was 55. Both of these gentlemen in their early 40s.
That's quite right, yes. I mean, the oldest one of the contenders, or seen as the potential contenders, is, of course, John Prescott, who's 52. After that comes Robin Cook, who's 48. Then it goes down to Gordon Brown at 43, and Tony Blair, the youngest of the lot, looks even younger than he is, actually. He's 41. So, as you say, yes, it would have skipped a generation. And it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, they do go for Tony Blair, what effect that has on the Conservative Party. I mean, at the moment, the pressure's been taken off John Major, but after the Euro elections, then who knows what might happen within the Conservative Party.
Well, that's right. One wonders if it might sway them more towards going for a new look, too. In fact, to have two different people facing each other at Prime Minister's Question Time.
Exactly, and it would make it easier for them to choose somebody of Michael Portillo's generation than it would have done, perhaps, previously. So it may actually improve his chances of taking over the Conservative leadership if there is a challenge to John Major.
You mentioned John Prescott there. It's a very difficult time for everybody to have enough respect and a period of mourning for John Smith, and also to get on with the job of keeping the Labour Party on a roll, which it has been for some time now. John Prescott is giving two television interviews today, apparently. Some are criticising him for adopting a high media profile. But, you know, he can't say no, though, can he, really?
It's very difficult to say no. The other thing is that some of these interviews, of course, were planned before, although he could have said, well, in view of the circumstances, yes, I'm going to cry off. But with the European election campaigning, all of these people, all of the possible contenders, are actually going to be out there campaigning. They're going to be out there making speeches. And everybody is going to be going over those speeches to say, ah, that's where he stands in the Labour Party. That is how he wants the Labour Party to be. So there is going to be some sort of campaigning, even if it is not in the name of a campaign for the leadership, but in the name of a European election campaign. I was musing, actually, in the Soviet Union, whenever a leader died, one always used to look to whoever it was who was put in charge of the funeral arrangements or made the oration at the funeral. That was the next leader of the Soviet Union. Well, we don't have that, of course, here. But it will be interesting to see how those candidates do perform during that European election campaign.
Now, of course, to have this unwanted battle for leadership thrust upon them is going to cost the Labour Party, in terms of finance here, around £3 million, it's been said. Can they afford it?
They can't afford it, really. No political party can afford that sort of cost. Whether it's going to cost up to £3 million, they will probably try and offset as much as that. They've got to go to the trade unions, of course, and get the money for it. And that actually might cause a slight difficulty, because the trade unions may not be very keen on having a large leadership contest and may say, well, we only want a new leader, because after all, Margaret Beckett is still deputy leader. She is still in situ until the party conference in October, when there could be a challenge to her job there. But the special conference may only choose the leader, so you will perhaps have two leadership contests this year, because if Tony Blair is put in as the new leader, or indeed if Robin Cook or John Prescott get it, they may decide that they would much rather there was a change and perhaps persuade somebody to challenge Margaret Beckett later in the year. So it is a rather difficult decision that the NEC has got to take. It is possible, of course, that Margaret Beckett may decide that, in fairness, she would step down as deputy leader as well on that same day and so provoke a dual contest.
Peter, thanks for talking to us this morning. Political editor Peter Murphy there. The official campaigning, of course, yet to start. But nevertheless, moves must be being made towards electing a new leader of the Labour Party. It's 12 and a half minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to LBC. It's Steve Jones with you. And in a moment or two, noises about noises over Heathrow.
You're tuned to LBC News Talk.
I sort of came in to help out on the music front. Ended up running the place.
Larry Price of the Dover Street Wine Bar.
It's a restaurant, a live jazz bar, it's a wine bar. It's a mixture of sort of jump, jive and swing jazz. Serious grown-up food. Got to keep the music good all the time. Most expensive thing I've ever bought. Now, you've got me there. Yes, it was a ring, and it was, funnily enough, on American Express. It's a confident card, which is quite a nice feeling. They hand over the American Express card, and you're happy. I certainly think it makes people feel comfortable, I think, American Express.
The Dover Street Wine Bar and Restaurant, one of the many jumping joints where American Express is welcomed. A bigger breakfast on the weekend with Steve Jones.
The main inquiry into planning applications by the British Airports Authority for a fifth terminal at Heathrow Airport doesn't actually open until spring next year, but the QC who will head that inquiry has already been appointed by the Environment Secretary John Gummer. He's Mr. Roy Vandermeer. And the first of several pre-inquiry meetings takes place tomorrow. Arguments for and against the merits of the plan won't be heard at this meeting, but those campaigning to stop the project getting off the ground have been organising themselves for some time, as John Bolton from the Heathrow Association to Control Aircraft Noise told me.
Yes, we've already submitted one or two preliminary papers, but of course for us the important issue is going to be how the inquiry is going to handle the thousands and thousands of people who've written in saying they wish to be heard, and that's going to be a real problem for the inspector.
Is it simply noise which you are objecting to?
Well, primarily, because that's how we got into business in the first place, but basically it's people in West London saying that Heathrow is becoming a total blight. It's not just noise, it's beginning to encroach on roads, it's air quality, danger, all the things that make life either civilised or uncivilised.
I mean, what sort of environmental damage would you envisage from the construction of service roads, which there would have to be, the moving of Perry Oaks sewage works and other civil engineering projects?
Clearly, I mean, there's going to be millions of tonnes of additional concrete being poured into Heathrow. And the fact that Heathrow is already overdeveloped and is already a nightmare city, to add this £1 billion worth of extra investment seems to us absolutely crazy. And particularly because the government has been saying for some time that all development really should be focused on the east side of London, which is where they need it, and not here where we don't need it. So we're saying you're putting the concrete and the investment in the wrong place.
Well, do you say that Heathrow is overexpanded already? BAA, of course, says that if this fifth terminal is not built, then 14,000 jobs would be lost and also billions of pounds worth of business.
Well, they're going to push the commercial argument to the nth. I mean, from our point of view, we see BAA as being just the number one retail agent in the country. For them, this is just an extended shopping mall, and so they're looking at their shopping profits. And to that extent, we're saying it's a pretty biased kind of picture they're painting.
Would it not, though, create jobs in the area? I mean, whether some which exist already would be lost. If you have a fifth terminal, many people who live in and around Heathrow would find themselves work there.
Well, again, most of the local councils in this area are already fighting it, saying that even if this jobs argument were to have any validity, it would then put the additional strain on all the arrangements, all the substructure, the roads, the need for new housing and so on. It's already selling into a crowded market.
We're talking here about a fifth terminal and not an extra runway, although, of course, that might still come. It could be discussed in the future. Do you think this is the thin end of the wedge?
Absolutely.
Is that runway to come eventually, do you feel?
That's entirely rarely the issue. We're saying if you don't draw the line here and now and you put another £1 billion worth of investment into a fifth terminal, then sure as eggs is eggs, it's going to be, well, we've made the investment, we now need to justify it, give us an additional runway. And as you know, this is under review at the moment. This, by putting a fifth terminal or getting permission for a fifth terminal, will then so bias the judgment that it's going to be the third runway coming down, and that would be a monumental disaster for West London. A whole new part of London being brought into the shadow, and it would be tremendously awful.
Of course, another runway is being considered, though, on the other hand, at Stansted. If that were to be built there, then at the an extra terminal would be built there too. Mm-hmm. We would have the same sort of protests, would we not, from people living on that side of town, from the sort that we're getting from you and other campaigners in the West?
Well, sure, and I mean, every time that we raise a cry on West London, everybody says it's NIMBY, it's not in our backyard. But, I mean, to put it into perspective, there are 500,000 people plus, anywhere between 500,000 and 2 million people in West London who have been putting up with this blight for years and years, and we're saying it's simply not fair to keep piling more and more into this pint pot of a thing called Heathrow. Let's think about the 21st century. Let's put the new capacity where it will not bring blight to people's lives. Now, the number one alternative, as far as we're concerned, is not Stansted, but building a totally new terminal in the Thames estuary. There's private funds available, there's the place to do it, and it would allow 24-hour flying. Nobody's nights, nobody's days would be threatened, would be spoiled, would be endangered. So we're saying to the government, draw the line here and now at Heathrow, start planning for the 21st century east of town, and let's put a sensible airport for the next century.
John Bolton there from the Heathrow Association to Control Aircraft Noise, objecting to the possibility of a fifth terminal at Heathrow. It's 18 and a half, well, actually it's almost 19 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we're going round the world now. I don't know if you spend your Sunday afternoons, or indeed any evening, dipping into the Scrabble bag, but you might have noticed that this past week in America, the game there is making moves to become politically correct. They've been throwing out some suspect words from those which are allowed to be used. Well, this set us wondering what you can say and what you can't. We're talking about political correctness here, and we put our worldwide sleuths on the trail, and where better to start than in the home of PC, New York, and our man Paul Woodley.
America, as I've noted before, tends to be a land of extremes, and it's also the home of political correctness. Put those two things together, and what happens is that what should have been a perfectly sensible re-examination of certain issues to see if perhaps some attitudes needed adjusting ends up as lunacy and absurdness. Or perhaps it's just that we reporters tend to focus on the extremes which make better stories, such things as the efforts by some to get curriculums changed so that in history classes, for example, teachers would junk the books they've been using for decades and substitute ones which say that Christopher Columbus, far from being a courageous pioneering hero who discovered America, was in fact nothing but a blunderer and a plunderer, who didn't know where he was going, didn't know where he was when he got here, and was responsible for the commercial despoiling of this country and the deaths of countless Native Americans, as we must now learn to call Indians. America's schools and universities are the major battlegrounds of the pro and anti forces with regard to political correctness, and the racial minorities in this country are a major focus of the effort. It is very difficult to properly analyse what's going on here. There are so many vested interests who insist on portraying their opponents as extremists. The debate is fierce and unlikely to reach any consensus. What is considered to be politically correct takes many forms. For example, there are now schools which teach so-called Afrocentric education to black pupils, or African Americans, to use the currently preferred term. Supporters of such schools say that teaching black children about the heroes of the civil rights movement and the history of Africa will boost their self-esteem and academic performance. The proponents of Afrocentric education insist that it's not ghettoizing youngsters, that they are not teaching the children to hate whites or to be separatists, but making sure that they know that all peoples have made a contribution to civilization. Critics say that the concept has been taken just too far. And then there is the other extreme. Schools in America are controlled by school boards, members of which are elected, though in polls with notoriously low turnouts. And just this week, a school board in a town called Tavares in Florida voted to require teachers in schools there to teach that American culture, values, and political institutions are, quote, unquestionably superior to other foreign or historic cultures. The school board, totaling five people, has three members, a majority who belong to a right-wing religious organisation, and they are also requiring teachers to promote strong family values and an appreciation of our American heritage and culture to ensure that pupils never forget that, quote, we are the best of the best. The local teachers' union and citizens' groups, complaining that the school board has been hijacked by religious zealots, are protesting, saying that what's being proposed is simplistic, jingoistic, undemocratic, and probably illegal. They want to challenge the policy in the courts, which will anyway lead to more debate, but given the fixed views of those involved, is not likely to lead to more understanding or tolerance. And that's Inside America.
With Paul Woodley, well, of course, the political scene has changed greatly in Russia in the past couple of years, but what about political correctness? Let's go to Moscow and Sue Jameson.
To the average Muscovite, the term political correctness probably means that Boris Yeltsin and the State Duma have agreed to respect the same subparagraph of the Constitution at the same time. Not something that happens very often. But political correctness in the sense we know it, well, let me give you two recent examples on racism and sexism, which are typical of the thought processes of a large majority of those who live and work here. A friend of mine was walking to the shops with her three-year-old daughter, who's white, and Rosie's black friend, Kumbi. The party attracted a fair amount of attention. Mostly people just stared because they're still not used to seeing black faces often in Moscow, but certainly they were wondering why this elegant white woman had children of such different colours with her. Finally, one man asked her, "What are you doing with the monkey?" This is not isolated. There were diplomats from Zimbabwe living in our block, and the man sometimes said he was sorry he'd ever learned Russian, because then he could understand all the things that people were saying loudly about him as he walked by. On sexism, there's an incredible degree of political incorrectness by our standards. Women may have been allowed to do all the back-breaking work in communist times, and indeed now, but that's as far as any equality goes. Yesterday, two friends went to the local market to buy bananas. The male stall holders leered openly, particularly as one of them was taking photographs. "So, girls," they called out, "where are your men?" Russians, as I've said before, are ridden with racism and sexism. They talk about chorni, blacks, and negroes with a spit in their voices. Or they use the expression "near nashi," not ours, about these darker-skinned people from the southern former republics. And then there's another side to political correctness here, how you deal with the Soviet legacy. There are so many times that people here still talk about the Soviet people instead of the Russian people. They still say the USSR, and few people have bothered to mentally adapt to the changes in road names and place names. I was in St. Petersburg just recently, but everyone in Moscow still said to me, "Oh, you're going to Leningrad, are you?" On the television news, there was an interesting change. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the terms SNG or CIS were used, and the republics were called by their chosen names. Belarus instead of Belarusia, Kyrgyzstan instead of Kyrgyzia. Now, recently, all that's changed, and news broadcasts have reverted to the old Soviet names. The official reason is that the old names are easier to say in Russian, but coinciding with an upsurge of Russian nationalism and influence, you do wonder.
Indeed you do. That was Sue Jameson there in Moscow. Well, of course, Japan is a land where two cultures meet and sometimes clash, one imagines, too. However, political correctness has secured something of a foothold there, as Tim Knight reports from Tokyo.
Perhaps surprisingly, political correctness has hit Japan, although perhaps not in the same way as in England or America. However, if you're a writer or a broadcaster, it is important that you watch what you say. Some politicians should be more careful. Last weekend, the Justice Minister, appointed only a few days before, resigned after claiming in a magazine interview that the slaughter of 200,000 or 300,000 Chinese citizens by Japanese troops in 1937, known as the Rape of Nanking, didn't really happen. He didn't resign immediately, but the outcry in Japan was too great for his credibility to remain intact, and his comments threatened Japan's recently more harmonious relations with China and South Korea, so he had to go. A year ago, the men who run Japan's civil service, some would say, therefore, that they run Japan, were agonizing over how best to write woman in official documents and laws. They were wondering if they could abandon the old-fashioned term fujin for the more modern one of josei, which is preferred by most women and has already been adopted by most local governments in official documents. The former is written in Japanese characters which combine those meaning female and broom. It's been attacked partly for being sexist, but interestingly enough, more generally, because it implies females become adults only when they marry. Generally, though, when it comes to matters that would be of concern to Anglo-Saxon feminists, you only have to watch a bit of late-night Japanese television or glance through the evening tabloids to see there is a lot of political incorrectness. And yet, when it comes to words, the media is increasingly hypersensitive. So as not to offend women, the word meaning effeminate or sissy is banned. If you want to describe someone like this, you have to say something like, he's not manly. There's also a case where a euphemism has been banned and replaced by something more blunt. The second used to infer the second wife or mistress. Now you have to say lover. People who are physically handicapped have often been kept out of the way by families embarrassed by their relatives' condition, and now words describing handicaps are pretty much outlawed too. For example, the word meaning blind should not be used. Instead, you must use words that have the equivalent meaning of visually challenged. The word for imbecile is out. Now it's a person whose mental development has been delayed. You can't even use a common phrase meaning half-finished, even on radio or television, because it's written with Chinese characters which show a person with one arm. Again, the anxiety is not to offend the handicapped. Some writers are getting angry at what they see as a restriction on their ability to express themselves as they'd like to. One well-known writer even stopped writing for the media completely last year in protest at the restrictions. It's also amusing to watch live television programs with members of the public contributing, because they often use a banned word, are quickly cut off, and then the presenter bows deeply and apologizes for the transmittance of the offending word.
Tim Knight there was in Tokyo. I'll look at political correctness around the world. OK, and here's a very fine, upstanding gentleman who has one or two words to share with you as far as the traffic is concerned. And it's Roberto the Burn at LBC Traffic Centre. Good morning.
Yes, good morning once again, Steve. Thanks for that intro. Up in Wood Green, Westbury Avenue, you've got temporary lights and roadworks there. We've just heard the temporary lights on Westbury Avenue are slightly out of phase, so that's going to cause some problems for motorists. Wandsworth along East Hill, heading westbound near the High Street. Look out for some westbound lane restrictions there. Tower Bridge, the north side, there's a mobile crane operating there. As a result of that, traffic subject to a single alternate lane flow. That's going to become busy as traffic starts to build up around the Tower Bridge northern approach. On Regent Street, between Langham Place and Great Castle Street, delays for southbound traffic because of lane restrictions. We've got lights out this morning on Denmark Street at the junction with Charing Cross Road. Public Transport Metropolitan Line, no service between Uxbridge and Rainers Lane. That's for weekend engineering work and should be removed by about 12 o'clock.
If you need an exhaust for your car, head for your local QuickFit Centre now. We have a huge range in stock at really competitive prices. For your nearest QuickFit Centre, call free on 0800 222 111.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
Independent speech radio has a sound future. Speech radio is the most informed and informative medium of the 90s, and you could be part of it. If you have the drive, the ambition and the commitment to become a key player in London's top radio sales team, then we want to talk to you. If you want to be part of a station where success is recognized and greatly rewarded, then call this number now. 071-973-1152. That's 973-1152. Radio sales. The future has never sounded so good.
LBC News Talk 97.3 News.
The headlines at 9:31. This is Roger Walker. Three opinion polls are tipping Tony Blair as the next Labour leader, but Margaret Beckett, who's taken charge since John Smith died, has again appealed to candidates to put off campaigning until after the European elections. The IRA is being blamed for the murder of a soldier in Northern Ireland. He died after an explosion at a security checkpoint in County Armagh, which is thought to have been caused by a mortar bomb. Salvage experts are preparing to tow a badly damaged cargo ship into port after a collision in the English Channel. The captain and first mate insisted on staying aboard the Taiwan-registered Ming Fortune, but the rest of the crew was airlifted to Lydd in Kent. The weather fine with plenty of sunshine this morning, but though we can expect more sunny spells this afternoon, it'll become rather cloudier. There'll be a few showers by evening, some of them heavy. Temperatures reaching a humid 20 degrees Celsius with a light southwest breeze. We'll take a break now, then we'll have the sport.
LBC News Talk. I'm with Carol Vielba of the City University to find out why they've been advertising their evening MBA courses on LBC.
I think that if you're trying to reach a wide audience in London, if you're trying to reach the kind of audience that we're reaching, which is primarily young managers, young people in business, advertising on LBC is highly effective. The LBC campaign has, for us, created a lot of general awareness.
Find out how you can benefit from advertising on LBC by calling the sales team during office hours on 071 973 1152. That's 973 1152.
Hello, I'm Mike Allen. Join me tonight at 9 o'clock on LBC Radio when we'll be putting the spotlight on medical matters with Dr. Christine Page. Then it's the qualifier quiz. First prize, £500 worth of Panasonic technology must be won tonight. There's open line with a lot of things to be talked about and a 12 o'clock midnight encounters. Join me tonight at 9 o'clock. We could talk.
Sport on the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
That's right. Let's start with motor racing this time, huh?
Indeed we will, and the world of motor racing will be trying to pull itself together at Monaco this afternoon for the first Formula One Grand Prix since Ayrton Senna and Roland Ratzenberger died at Imola. Michael Schumacher, who swept the board so far this season, will be in pole position with Mika Hakkinen second, followed by Gerhard Berger and Damon Hill. The front row will be left empty in tribute to the two dead drivers. Damon Hill, who will carry the Williams-Renault banner alone today, says it's impossible to forget the tragedy of Imola.
My thoughts are on many different levels. Unfortunately, they're not entirely on the race. I wish I could come here and just be thinking about the race, but it's just not possible.
Damon Hill. We'll be talking to Mike Dickin, actually, in about 10 minutes, our motoring expert, about that Grand Prix in Monaco this afternoon. Well, to happier matters, the victorious Manchester United team will parade the FA Cup through their home city today. Their 4-0 win over Chelsea at Wembley made them only the fourth team this century to complete the double of Cup and League Championship. Striker Mark Hughes says it's a wonderful achievement.
It's a fantastic moment for everyone involved. This great club's never done the double before, and to be part of a team that has is very special.
And one of the things people keep saying is that it's marvellous in the year that you lost Sir Matt Busby to pay this tribute to him.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the only sad point, that he's not here to celebrate it with us, but I'm sure he's up there somewhere, he's smiling.
United's first two goals were scored by Eric Cantona, both penalties, and the second one highly controversial. The champions went into the match having lost both this season's Premiership games with Chelsea, but Cantona says he never felt any tension before the final.
It's just a game, it's not a war. It's very nice. It's very nice to score. It's very nice to play in this stadium in the FA Cup final. So why to be nervous when it's so nice?
The promotion playoff semi-finals take place today. In the First Division, Millwall travel to Derby. Leicester City, who've lost the last two playoff finals, are away to Tranmere Rovers. The Division 2 games see Burnley take on Plymouth Argyle and York City against Stockport County. In the Third Division, it's Carlisle United against Wickham Wanderers and Torquay United versus Preston North End. Cricket. Surrey, unbeaten so far this season, play Derbyshire today in the AXA Equity and Law Sunday League at the Oval. The home team's David Ward goes into the game on the back of a superb double hundred in the Championship match against the same opponents. He says batsmen will always prosper at Surrey HQ.
It's always a good wicket, good batting wicket, especially for the one day, as people like to get after the ball, and the ball comes on nicely. So, we enjoy coming here and scoring runs. The bowlers don't like bowling too much on it, but they get a bit of bounce if they work hard, so hopefully we'll look forward to a good game.
Finally, tennis. Boris Becker will play Pete Sampras in the final of the Italian Open in Rome. Becker is aiming to win a clay court tournament for the first time in his career.
Roger, thank you very much for that. It's 24 minutes to 10 o'clock now. Peter Dealey is indisposed this weekend, so I'm very glad to say that between 10 and midday, you have Martin Young as your host, and that gives Martin a Sunday morning opportunity to support the country casuals rather than the Savile Row number for which he's noted.
No, it's Simon Bates who's giving away my entire wardrobe day by day, 11:30 every day. No, I thought But the weekend show, very civilised, just come in looking as elegant as yourself.
Thank you very much indeed. So what have you got for us this
week? Well, of course, it's been an extraordinary week, an extraordinarily sad week, hasn't it, with the death of John Smith. I mean, we're all shocked that he had a second heart attack, and then around, when was it, 9:30 that day, we began to hear the rumours that possibly he was dead, and that built and built, and then of course, we learnt at 10 o'clock, and I think it was extraordinary for many reasons. You've seen the reaction of politicians, whom you'd expect immediately to be jockeying for position, although no doubt that's going on, it's not evidently going on, and journalists as well, whom you'd expect to have been fairly sort of, oh, well, that's interesting, let's get into the politics of this. There was a genuine sadness, a nice man. I don't know if you've met him, I met him a few times, and I thought he was a very genuine person and will greatly be missed. But, of course, we will turn to look at the politics. Frank Dobson's going to be with me to talk about when and where the election will take place. He doesn't want to talk, naturally, about personalities at this stage, but we'll talk to Frank about that and, of course, look back at John Smith's career. We're also going to be looking back 50 years to D-Day because we've got two books published this week, and I'll be talking to a veteran of the Normandy landings and also to a historian who's put the whole thing together. I'm particularly interested because I, too, wrote a book about D-Day.
Did you?
But it's all right. It's about 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not really plugging it, but it is something I'm very interested in.
Available now at your local boot market.
That's the one. And finally, Steve, we're going to look at a ballet called Highland Fling. If you fancy watching ballet in kilt and tartans, you don't have to wear kilt and tartans.
Thank goodness, yes.
We'll tell you all about that as well.
Good. A little bit of ballet on the show.
Indeed.
Culture on a Sunday morning.
Oh, what?
I tell you. Is there anything worn under your kilt? No, it's all in perfect working order.
Oh, right, we get all the latest ones on this show.
Harry Lord in 1926. Thank you, Marty. Martin is with you after the news, of course, at 10 o'clock. I'll talk to Mike Dickin about the Formula One Grand Prix in Monaco after this.
LBC News Talk.
To stand out in today's marketplace and really be heard, use radio. Call London Broadcasting Sales on 071 973 1152.
Hello, Art Malik here. And I want to remind you about Cadbury's Strollathon 94. It's going to be a great day for everyone, and it's all to raise money for Save the Children and One Small Step. So come and join LBC and 20,000 people on the streets of London on Sunday, July the 17th. It costs nothing to take part, so register now. Call 071-232...
This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Well, 2 weeks ago, Formula One drivers Ayrton Senna and Roland Ratzenberger were killed on the circuit at Imola. This weekend, 25-year-old Austrian Karl Wendlinger lies in a critical but stable condition in hospital after crashing in practice at Monaco. However, the Grand Prix does go ahead today with German Michael Schumacher in pole position. Earlier, I spoke to our motoring man, Mike Dickin. On Friday, the FIA, the sport's governing body, announced a radical package of safety measures, but presumably too late for today's race.
Yeah, nothing much will happen today, except the drivers will be very aware of it. There have been some changes in the pit lane, and they'll have to stay to a speed of 80 kilometres an hour in the pit lane today, and that'll be very carefully monitored.
Do you think it was touch and go as to whether this race would go ahead today anyway?
I think if Bendlinger had died, or it looked happily as though he is going to make a complete recovery, I don't think there's any doubt that Prince Rainier would have said, no, we're not having this race. He did say that on Friday, and I believe that the FIA and Max Mosley would have agreed with him. I don't think there would have been any argument. A few years ago, they'd have said, no, the race goes on, but in view of what's happened this year, I think there was little doubt, had Wendlinger died, the race would have been stopped.
Now, some of those proposals listed on Friday were described as a knee-jerk reaction, and some teams are complaining that they're going to miss races because they can't implement the new regulations. I mean, is that going to be a problem for some of them?
One or two of the teams at the bottom end of the money scale, once again, are going to suffer because of all of a sudden new rules, new regulations, new changes. The teams at the top end of the money league, they can do it. They've got the facilities, they've got the cash. But once again, some of the other teams will not be ready for the Spanish Grand Prix.
What about this particular circuit itself? I mean, it's really, I suppose, really the showpiece of the Formula One circuit of the year. It's certainly the big circus in a very, very splendid environment. Is it as difficult as many of the others?
It's the slowest circuit. But having said that, they come out of the tunnel somewhere between 160 and 180 miles an hour, which of course is just there, fending out his accident, but he was only doing about 50 when he had his accident. It's the sort of circuit that makes you want to try because it's so twisty, it's so up and down, it's so challenging to the drivers. But frankly, if you're in front, you can control the race. I think Schumacher's going to have a very easy run this afternoon.
Right, because he's in pole position. As long as he stays there, then that's it. It's not easy to get past him.
Very, very difficult.
This question of safety, of course, I mean, which has been brought very sharply into focus after those two fatalities 2 weeks ago and this accident with Wendlinger. Yes, of course, nobody wants to see fatalities on a motor racing circuit, but it is dangerous. And do the drivers want, do they want safety or do they want speed?
Well, there are some who are very, very safety conscious, but even they, if they were offered a car that would do 180 miles an hour, but it hasn't got all the safety features, or one that would do 150 miles an hour that had all the safety features, they take the one that does 180.
I mean, there have been, as you and I have discussed on the programme before the season really got underway a few weeks ago now, changes to the vehicles from the way that they were designed in the past couple of years. Have any of these changes made any difference, do you think, in terms of safety? Could they have contributed, in fact, to the two fatality crashes and this accident which took place a couple of days ago?
It's difficult to know because we don't yet know what caused the accidents that killed Ratzenberger and Senna. We're not altogether clear what happened to Wendlinger, although he did brake a little later than he had on his previous lap. I'm in favour of most of the changes. I think it was silly to take ABS off the cars. If you can brake and steer at the same time, it's a great advantage to anybody. It's on most road cars. I think it should be on the race cars.
Because, again, today, as a mark of respect for the two drivers who died a couple of weeks ago, there are going to be two empty spaces on the grid behind Schumacher, and then Damon Hill is lying at around about fourth, I think. Whoever wins this year's championship, there's not going to be, at the end of the season, that much cause for celebration, is there?
I would like to believe that's true, Steve, but come the end of this season, which is still some way ahead, I'm afraid that Ratzenberger and Senna will be a distant memory. There will be a massive celebration if Schumacher goes on and wins virtually every Grand Prix, which it looks like he'll do.
I was talking there to LBC's motoring man, Mike Dickin, from his country seat, to which he retreats at the weekend after a very hard week on London Talkback Radio, and also presenting, of course, Freewheeling on a Saturday lunchtime. The time now is 16 and a half minutes to 10 o'clock. In a moment, we will meet Chris de Berg.
How do you say thank you in French without getting your face slapped? How do you order a dessert in France without ending up with a plate full of sand? Or what do you say to a French woman that wants to roll a shovel with you? How do you order a steak in France without the waiter thinking you've got BO? And what kind of noise do you have to make in Avignon to end up in a brothel?
Find out what mistakes you've been making in your French with the help of Voilà, a four-part French course, free in today's Observer. And stop your French from being double Dutch.
A bigger breakfast on the weekend with Steve Jones.
Now, is this the man who brought us Lady in Red and also A Spaceman Came Travelling? It is. It's Chris de Berg from his new album out tomorrow and the new single already in the shops called Blonde Hair, Blue Jeans. are long awaited. It's Blonde Hair Blue Jeans, the new single from Chris de Burgh, and it's from the album which is out tomorrow on A&M Records, This Way Up. And that way up, right opposite me now, is the young man himself. A very good morning to you. Nice to see you.
Good morning, good morning.
Long awaited this. Well, it's a couple of years since the last album, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, the last record, Power of Ten, came out 2 years ago, and I followed that up with a world tour that went on for about, I guess, 9 months. Did 100 shows, started off in Athens, underneath the Acropolis, open-air show, I guess about 15,000 people, and it was a fantastic night. And the back of the stage gave towards the sea, and there was a storm at sea with flashes of lightning, and the Greek gods themselves are obviously joining in. And the final show, 100 shows later, was in Johannesburg early last year, where we did a live transmission in aid of Operation Hunger. It's the, you know, black charity. Mm. And following that, I took a short holiday and I started working on this one, so it's all hard work.
See, things seem to go in 2 year cycles for you, don't they, in terms of recording and doing these lengthy tours. I mean, I know there's another one coming up with what, three successive dates, almost successive here in London this year.
That's right.
But it takes 2 years to get all that planned, I imagine, doesn't it?
Well, we started working on this current tour at least 2 years ago. And the dates that you mentioned in London, the Albert Hall, we were actually putting another two on sale this week. So it looks like we may be doing five or six, perhaps, depending on the demand. And it will be part of a UK tour that actually, the tour itself begins, I think, I don't read these things anymore, the bulletins, but I think we're going to Beirut to start with. We did a Middle East tour, as I said earlier, Athens, and one of the highlights, actually, for that was a place called Ephesus in Izmir.
Oh, yes.
And Ephesus is this fantastic Colosseum, which has been there since time began. Actually, 2nd century BC, and St. Paul was lecturing them on graven images of Diana. Even back then, you see, she was popular. And everything is exactly as it was, and it's beautiful.
Mm. Did you like playing these huge open-air amphitheatres, whether they be from hundreds of thousands of years ago, or whether it's the newer type of stadium? Is that the sort of milieu that you enjoy working in most?
Very much, Steve. I get the biggest thrill from the big places. Last summer, I did a series of open-airs in Germany, and it was the three-day festivals, and the other headline acts were Prince did, like, the Friday night, and Rod Stewart, Tina Turner, double-headed Saturday night, and I did the Sunday night with my band. And there was 100,000, 120,000 people each night, and I find that real exciting. Mm. And some people have been saying, you know, tracks on this new album, like Blonde Hair, Blue Jeans, The Silent World, This Weight on Me, they're all very tough. They're rock and roll. Has anything changed? Well, as a matter of fact, I've always been doing that, back to Don't Pay the Ferryman and High on Emotion. Lady in Red was a bit of a curve, to be honest, in my career, because I do write ballads as well as rock songs, and that just happened to be the one that sort of jumped out of the bag.
And that was Curve with a V and not Curse with an S.
No, I'm delighted with the success, but it's the quieter song that I do in my show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that because when I first met you, I think it was 1973, 74 in Scotland when I was working up there and you were on tour. I mean, a career which has lasted now over 20 years, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Has it taken care of itself, or have you been a person who's been very much in control of what's happened all the time?
Well, to a certain extent, I think I've controlled my destiny, but it's been obviously a tremendous struggle. I don't think anybody has any illusions about how the difficult it is, particularly for a solo artist, to not only become successful, but to remain successful. And a lot of it has got to do with the fact that the general public still like what I do. I've come to this point now where tomorrow, the release of my 11th album, and it's like 130 recorded songs, and the word back from those who've heard it, and certainly I've been at two playbacks, one in Paris last week and one in London a few weeks back, is that people are just jumping up and down saying it's the best thing I've ever done. Well, I kind of take that in my stride, but I'm very quietly extremely pleased with the way this record has turned out after all that length of time. I think it's a learning process. For me, my big, I suppose, change of heart was during last summer when my wife was thrown off a horse, broke her neck, and would have died except she didn't move. And earlier this week, when John Smith died, for example, I was down at your studios, and the news came right through at that point. Mm. So I curtailed my interview. But life can drastically change at a moment, moment's notice, or no notice at all. And I thought, well, I've got to, in my music, reflect this celebration of life and this joy that one has of being alive, for Christ's sake, and go for it, you know. And
celebrate it while you can, because it won't necessarily... Well, it won't be there forever. We all know that.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
The career, as I say, has spanned that many years. And you mentioned 11 albums in that time. There are other artists who would have, in the early stages of the career, actually swamped the market with stuff. I mean, it's a lot of recorded material, as you mentioned, in terms of the number of songs. Mm-hmm. But it's been well eked out, shall we say, because no matter how creative an individual you are, there is probably only so much music inside a person. And if you get rid of it all in the first couple of years, then the muse can desert you quite easily, can't it?
Well, funnily enough, Steve, they always say the second album is the toughest, because the material you write for your first one has been written over a number of months, years, perhaps. And then suddenly you're confronted with having to do a second album. And I think I got over that one by writing the album Spanish Train and Other Stories, with tracks like the title track, Lonely Sky, Patricia the Stripper, Spaceman Came Travelling, and so on. And I realised that if I could do that, I could really carry on. There was obviously some very dark moments where nothing seemed to be happening, and then out of the box would be something ludicrous. On the face of it would be somebody rang and said, your album is the biggest selling album of all time in Norway. This is 1978 or something. And people would laugh and say, well, Norway, what's Norway? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, it's about 150,000 albums, and it's telling me that someone somewhere likes what I do. And that sustains you throughout your career. If I only put out 11, well, only, it means that the rest of those years were spent touring, and very few of them were spent actually sitting about. But on this new record, I discovered something that I had never done before. Always thought about it. Which was the first time I stood with a full orchestra in a studio to sing with them, was with George Martin in December last year, where he was making a record with Larry Adler, Gershwin Hits.
Oh, yes, yes.
And other people on this record are Cher, Elton John, Sting, Peter Gabriel, so on. And I stood with this orchestra, sang the song, album track in less than 20 minutes, 15 minutes. The following morning, I recorded two more of my own album tracks with the same thing, stood with the orchestra. I requested, can I stay with the orchestra? And they said, please do. We want you to be there. And I lifted myself and I sang as good as I think I've ever sung. And we did actually four tracks, three of which are on this album, with full orchestra. I'd love to come back to that. This balances the record away from the hard rock stuff into these other tracks. Mm. And I was very pleased with that. One day I think I'll do my favourite songs in an album, and it'll take 2 days instead of 3 months.
Well, get the orchestrations done first and then you pop in and add the voice later.
Oh,
or whatever.
It's wonderful. Mm. London man Nick Ingman worked with the London Session Orchestra, and it's just such a buzz.
Mm. Well, the great thing is that you are still getting the buzz after all these years of that. And one says all these years, 20 years is, in most popular musicians' eyes, it's probably three or four careers. I mean, if you can look at five and say, well, I'm doing well, can't you? At 10, well, this is amazing. And when you're not far off a quarter of a century now, it's almost unbelievable.
Well, I find it hard to believe as well, because my audience worldwide spans all ages. When I do concerts in Europe, if there's a 10,000-seat arena, I would say 60% of those people are under 20, and then the rest are sort of scattering of all ages. When I play in the UK, it'll be the same thing. There'll be those who maybe knew me from the earlier albums, people. And there's going to be a lot of people discovering me, as it were, for the first time with this Way Up album, because it's offering a harder edge that perhaps they hadn't heard on record before. But
You're always going to be new to somebody, yes.
Absolutely. And I just find it thrilling that, you know, I can sit in my little studio in Ireland and write songs that are heard in Guatemala, Bolivia, I mean, Lebanon. We're going to play a date in Beirut.
Yes, I've got that down here.
Later in the year.
Yes, you're going two dates, I believe, there. And you're going back to Greece again. I don't know if you knew that. You're playing Istanbul, Romania. In fact, you start the tour in Romania, it would appear.
You've obviously got the sheet. They don't give me this stuff. But the Beirut shows two dates. I think the first one, in case bombs fall, I think you go and put the second one in.
As I was going to say, stand by for presenter's joke. You should have finished the tour in Romania because it's so long, you'll need to book a rest at that time. Oh, dear.
And that was pretty good, Steve.
It wasn't bad for this time on a Sunday morning. Listen, we're looking forward to your dates. The ones we have so far, boys and girls in London, are the 3rd, 4th and 6th at the Royal Albert Hall. But, Chris, you're saying that... Two more dates have been added, and maybe more.
Perhaps, yeah.
Perhaps. Well, thanks for joining us again. Pleasure to see you after all these years.
Thank you.
And don't forget, the album is out tomorrow, This Way Up, from which we played the single earlier. And still on A&M. You stayed with the same label all these
same
years,
label,
too.
Same label, A&M Records, yeah. Mm. And in fact, they called me about 2 weeks ago and said D-Day celebrations are ending the night of June the 6th on the QE2 in Cherbourg. And a track from this album called Up Here in Heaven, which is the viewpoint of a dead soldier looking down on memorial going on and saying that up here in heaven we're all soldiers from every single country in the world and war is crazy. And they want to end the whole D-Day celebrations with this song, which I will be performing on the QE2. So obviously I said to the record company, delighted. That's a very exciting thing to be involved with.
Sure, absolutely.
But it's a great collaboration, great partnership down these years.
Great to see you again, Chris. Thanks for being with us.
Steve.
And so from Chris de Burg, we move to the man in black, Rob de Burn, at the LBC Traffic Centre. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning once again, Steve, and good morning, Chris, as well. Well, on the northern approach to Tower Bridge, you've got a mobile crane operating there. Traffic subject to a single alternate lane flow because of that. It's also being controlled by temporary lights, the flow there, so it is a little slow. And up in Wood Green on Westbury Avenue, look out for temporary lights there through the roadworks. The lights are out of phase, so that's causing some delays as well. Lights are out down Denmark Street junction with Charing Cross Road.
If you're on the M11, consider this. The average train journey on Network Southeast takes just 40 minutes from Harlow to London. Leave the car at home. Take a Network Southeast train.
Rob Byrne reporting at the LBC Traffic Centre.
Enough, they cry. But can we have some more next week? Well, of course you can, between 6 and 10 on the next Saturday and 7 and 10 on Sunday, when I'll be back behind the microphone here at LBC. Taking my place after the news at 10 o'clock and also taking the place of Peter Deely, who sadly is a little bit ill this Sunday morning, will be Martin Young, who'll bring you a fine show between 10 and midday. Among his guests, Frank Dobson, somebody along from Maury Poles, and also Brendan Bruce, a former top Tory image maker. And they'll be looking ahead to the forthcoming battle for the Labour Party leadership after the sad death of John Smith. They'll also be previewing the D-Day celebrations, and a ballet dancer will join Martin, who's on points even as we speak. From me, Steve Jones, until next weekend. Bye-bye.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Have you got the time, please?
No, I haven't. I've just sold my entire collection of top-quality watches to Austin Kay, the jewelers in the Strand, receiving a fabulous cash price on the spot. Austin Kay are always looking to purchase quality second-hand watches such as Rolex, Patek Philippe, Cartier, Breitling and Hoyer, paying up to as much as £7,000 for certain models. Austin Kay, they'll take time off your hands and put cash in your pocket.
It won't take time off my hands because I haven't got a watch.
Then go to Austin Kay and buy one.
Austin Kay at 425 The Strand, the place to sell and buy your quality watch. Call 071-240-1888. That's 240-1888.
Hello, this is Michael Van Straten inviting you to join me for Body Talk this Sunday evening. Your finger on the pulse of London's health. I'm joined by Paul Dolan and John Ash, California's most famous organic winemaker. Nutritionist Amanda Ursel will cast her beady eye over the food, and I'll be talking to the magnificent Joan Collins in an exclusive report on her philosophy for healthy living. So join me on Sunday evening at 6 on LBC News Talk 97.3 FM.
LBC News Talk 97.3.
News.
It's 10 o'clock. I'm Roger Walker. Tony Blair is emerging as the front-runner to become the next leader of the Labour Party. Three opinion polls give him a clear lead over Gordon Brown and John Prescott. But the Liberal Democrat leader, Paddy Ashdown, is warning that whoever takes over from John Smith faces a tough job explaining what the party now stands for. Mr Ashdown claims the public is confused about where Labour is going.
If the Labour Party does not stand for socialism, what is its core message? And that's a very, very difficult task indeed, because I don't think that that situation is yet known to the British public. And in the end, they're not going to vote for a party in the numbers necessary to bring it to power unless they know what it stands for.
A young soldier has been killed in an explosion in Northern Ireland. The IRA has been blamed for the attack in the South Armagh village of Keady. David Stokes reports.
The soldier was manning a permanent vehicle checkpoint near the police station in the centre of Keady when the attack was mounted just before midnight. It's believed the terrorists used a horizontally fired mortar detonated by command wire. Another soldier had to be treated for shock, and a number of families living nearby have been evacuated from their homes as security forces carry out a follow-up search of the area this morning. Local councillors say the villagers are sickened by the murder.
The Home Office has dismissed reports that police officers are to carry guns openly in the streets as very speculative. Today's Mail on Sunday says approval is likely to be given for police to sit in patrol cars with weapons on their laps. The Home Secretary is thought to be considering a limited increase in the arming of officers. Tutsi rebels in Rwanda are gaining ground from the Hutu tribe, pressing further south in the country's civil war. The advance by the Rwandan Patriotic Front is claiming still more victims, as Gerard Harlow reports.
Bodies continue to flow down the Ukangera River dividing Rwanda and Tanzania, a clear sign that as the fighting continues, so does the ethnic cleansing. Just a few kilometres up a nearby road in Tanzania, 250,000 refugees who fled the butchering, up to 3,000 cross the Ukangera every day and make their way to this makeshift city. Many pray the Tutsis regain control soon so they can return to their homes without the threat of being a victim of another senseless killing.
The Conservative MP Terry Dix has admitted telling the government of Qatar to go ahead with the flogging of a British man. Gavin Sherrard-Smith received 50 strokes of the cane and a six-month prison sentence for breaking drinking laws. Mr. Dick says the Qataris were fully within their rights.
What they do in their country is their business, nothing to do with you, me, or the British government. And if he doesn't like the punishment meeting out, he shouldn't have broken the law. I only wish we had corporal punishment here. If we had corporal punishment, half of these thugs wouldn't be getting away with half the things they're getting away with. Indeed, they wouldn't even be doing it because they know the punishment would be severe.
The manager of a Burger King restaurant is recovering after being abducted by two robbers at an M1 service station in Bedfordshire. The men, thought to be armed with knives, grabbed him after escaping with £3,000 in cash from the outlet at Toddington Services. He was bundled into a car and then dumped 5 miles away, where he phoned police. LBC Sport, Manchester United are celebrating the first League and Cup double in their history. The Reds' 4-0 victory over Chelsea at Wembley makes them only the fourth team this century to pull off the feat. Today they'll parade the cup through Manchester. Manager Alex Ferguson says the double is richly deserved.
I think they've distinguished themselves in modern-day football. They play attacking football. We entertain. And I think any claim they get, they deserve it.
And the weather. Fine with plenty of sunshine this morning, but though we can expect more sunny spells this afternoon, it'll become rather cloudier. There'll be a few showers by evening, some heavy. Temperatures reaching a humid 20 degrees Celsius today with a light southwest breeze. Muggy with more showers tonight. Some heavy rain with showers tomorrow.
Good morning. It's coming up to 5 minutes past 10 this Sunday morning. I'm Martin Young, standing in for Peter Deely from now until midday. Well, it's been a sad week, dominated by the sudden death of the Labour leader John Smith. We'll be looking back at his achievements in the company of his shadow cabinet colleague Frank Dobson. And we'll be taking a fresh look at the amount of stress we ask our MPs to endure. Isn't it time we turned the House of Commons into a proper place of work with sensible hours? What do you think? Do give me a call after 10:30 this morning on 0719739733 or 0716031152. And we'll be looking back 50 years to D-Day with a veteran of the Normandy landings and a historian who's chronicled what was the beginning of the end of World War II. And we'll finish with a flourish, a new ballet called Highland Fling. So do stay with me for the next couple of hours.
You're tuned to LBC News Talk.
Now, where would you get a home to look this stylish? The person who lives here has a lot of taste. The wallpapers are tremendously chic, and the chandeliers very Hollywood. I have an inkling as to who this mystery guest might be. You'd only get a home this gorgeous in Texas. Not the place, the store, Texas Home Care. This person has chosen their paint from the Dulux range and coordinated Jeff Banks wallpaper to match. Superb! Ah, Texas value. Every home should have some.
The death of Labour leader John Smith is likely to speed up cross-party plans to reduce the number of late nights worked by MPs in the House of Commons. Westminster sits for longer than almost all other parliaments in Europe, and there's now pressure from MPs on all sides of the House to make their working hours less extreme. Ashley Weinberg is an occupational psychologist at Manchester University. He's carried out a study of the workload, stress and lifestyle problems among MPs. He's on the line to me now. Ashley, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, first of all, what would be a typical kind of working week for an MP?
Well, I think one has to start there and take issue with that. There's probably no such thing. Every MP who responded to the study we carried out, and there were 124 of them, said, well, you know, we'll try and fill in the questionnaire we best we can, but really, no 2 weeks are the same. Every day is different, and we're very much on the receiving end of all the inquiries and demands that are being made of us.
So, I mean, it's not just, of course, the actual hours of the Commons. It's particularly if you're high profile, as John Smith naturally was.
Yeah.
It's all the media inquiries and interviews as well, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, what we tend to focus on is the time they're actually sitting in the House of Commons. And yes, the House of Commons sits longer than any other parliament. But when that isn't in session, there are committee stages, there are the media demands, there's meeting constituents and the powerful lobby groups that also predominate down at Westminster. And so there are so many different demands. MPs responding to our study, most of them were expressing very low levels of control over their lives. They were being pushed and pillared around, if you like, and it was producing mental and physical symptoms of stress to the extent that one in six show quite poor psychological health compared to a sample of British managerial workers, and one in three quite poor physical health. And I mean by both of these that they're not diagnostic terms. They are showing symptoms of mental and physical stress, so that's quite high.
What sort of symptoms are we talking about?
Well, from the physical point of view, we're looking at the kind of lack of motivation, sleep problems, overcompensating by drinking and smoking too much, stomach problems, headaches, and that kind of thing.
Now, I'm just thinking about actually talking to Chris Patton before the last election when he was party chairman, and him telling me that during one particular day he'd done 26 media interviews,
right,
then a foreign press briefing, followed by a lobby briefing.
Yeah.
And of course, as party chairman, one word out of place during all those interviews could have been frontline news the following day.
Well, yes. I mean, it's just an example of the high-pressure environment, if you like, that MPs are working within. It's very much a hothouse, a greenhouse, you know, everybody's waiting just for them to put one word wrong, and that must produce tremendous pressure as well.
But Michael Heseltine was saying yesterday, and speaking for obvious reasons, because of his own heart attack, that his doctors had said it might be unhealthy for him to stop that kind of stressed life, that could actually be bad for him as well.
Well, stress isn't all bad news. I mean, a lot of us need a certain amount of stress to get the best out of our lives. I mean, the MPs in our study were showing very high need to have this kind of stress in their lives, if you like. They were showing a type A personality characteristics. That's the competitive, ambitious approach to life, more so than other occupational groups, as one would expect. And obviously, many of them thrive on that. Seriously altering one's lifestyle and perhaps having to give up high-profile politics, yes, I can imagine that can be a shock to the system. But certainly there have to be sensible steps. I mean, once one recognises that there is a problem, to make sure you're coping as an individual and doing the sorts of things which will reduce the likelihood of a reoccurrence of a serious problem.
It's interesting because I see quite a correlation here with broadcast journalism,
yeah.
In that you're talking about MPs not getting away from the house till midnight or even 2-3 in the morning. If you do the morning programme on LBC or indeed any other similar morning programme on television, you get up about 3:30, you drive...